This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by Mark Kustra, who spent 23 years in the U.S. Marine Corps as an ASP adjunct fellow and an expert on stability ops. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So stability ops is stability operations, is a term that gets thrown around a lot in D.C. And in anywhere that someone from D.C. finds themselves temporarily. But we're not so good at defining what that is. So let's start there.
Very good question. And that's part of the problem. It's not very clearly defined. It's kind of a catch-all term that Department of Defense uses for operations. The key elements of it is it's conducted overseas. It's not internal due to posse comitatus, those kind of things. We do not do stability operations at home in the U.S. At least the Department of Defense does not. And the other element is that it inherently involves all elements of national power or multiple elements of national power. So that implies interagency and often intergovernmental or multinational flavors. But part of the challenge, like you said, is the definition gets thrown around a lot because under that umbrella includes quite a bit of things as far as from disaster relief or humanitarian assistance all the way to post-combat operations in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Well, in post-combat operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, hot topic always. And it's interesting to think that they fall, that kind of activity falls under the same as humanitarian assistance, disaster relief. So, you know, kind of comparing what the U.S. Marine Corps did in the Philippines after Typhoon Haiyan to what continues to go on in Iraq and Afghanistan, where we have troops on the ground. Do you think that that causes some turmoil in terms of, dare I say, the stability ops community, with such a wide variety of obligations and responsibilities that are each very delicate and very unique? It's sort of like, I don't know, it seems almost like it could get messy very quickly.
In the very nature of it being so interagency and multinational, it is often messy because it is a whole of a government issue. And often, actually, the easiest is humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, because there are clearly defined authorities. USAID handles it very well, and the military has a very limited role in those types of operations, usually related to logistics or unique capabilities that we can bring. Where it gets messier is in those situations like Iraq or Afghanistan, where the military is the dominant element out there, but yet a lot of what is required is inherently civilian, civ-mil type operations that are not necessarily the expertise within the military.
So what are some of those responsibilities that the military finds themselves with in more what we think of traditional stability ops situations, post-combat environments?
Right. A lot of that is things like rule of law, governance, and then development side of it. The security stuff is very much in the realm of the military.
Sure.
It can be challenging, though, because police and, our system doesn't like us training police, but in a lot of countries, the Army is very much internally focused instead of externally focused like our military is. So it often leads to some overlap and friction points, quite honestly, with State Department and other interagency folks who might not want us training police or training military and police-like skills.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. At least in the U.S., the military and the police are in very separate realms. Those friction points, do you think they get in the way of success? And perhaps even before we get to that question, is are we successful in this?
I think it was Zhao Enlai said it's too soon to tell based on how the French Revolution turned out. But I would argue we aren't as successful as we could be. There has been some success, but we are our own worst enemies at times, and a lot of that has to do with the whole of government approach and becoming a better interagency. Where I've seen it work the best is before the, what we call left of the boom, before the combat operations. So what in the military terms would be phase zero, which is shaping operations. My own experience is in Thailand, is it's much easier to build an airplane while it's on the runway than it is to try to build it while you're in the air.
Yeah.
And I think that's the challenge in those environments where, like in Iraq or Afghanistan, where you don't have a functioning government or the entire apparatus of a government, it is much harder to get a lot of progress in any timely manner.
So it sounds like you're saying, one, it's easier to solve a problem before you have a problem, right? It's easier to build, reinforce, maintain rule of law, human rights, strong governance structures, general stability, whether it be market, security, socioeconomic, et cetera, before there's conflict, which is a fairly logical point. So what are some examples of, you know, U.S. military involved in stability ops pre-conflict?
It's going on all over the world, really. In particular, it's very important in places where we're not actually fighting, or mm-hmm. where we are, where there is fighting going on, but the U.S. is not directly involved. Like, say, Africa, and in my case, in Thailand as well, we were training Thai military away from their own insurgency, but it was their fight, but we were trying to help provide them tools to be more efficient in that fight and to prevent it from becoming a worse problem for them.
Sure. So when you say, you know, on the African continent, we're talking about places like Burundi, Sudan and South Sudan, Nigeria, Liberia, lots of very unique, socially, culturally, politically, economically, very unique places. And then you kind of juxtapose that with some place like Thailand, which is where most of your experience is. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that and what your goals or the goals of your unit were in Thailand, and how you got there.
Well, my job in Thailand, actually, the last job I had in Thailand is part of the country team, actually, which mm-hmm. made it. And that, to me, is where if the interagency works or whole government approach works, it works best at the country team.
Okay.
And in some ways, in the future, I would hope that we empower them more to take and resolve some of those issues at the country team level, because generally where the friction points occurred is when it got back to here in Washington, D.C., of, you know, the Rice Bowl mentality of, no, that's a my lane, you guys stay out of that, instead of just get the mission done. Whereas I think most ambassadors and their staffs out there at the country level understand some of the nuances that maybe this makes sense.
Right, because you're actually there, you know the players, you know the community, you know all of these really important nuanced aspects of
right.
what makes sense in a particular and unique environment. So it's almost depoliticized, right? It definitely is depoliticized. You're focused on a mission rather than all the other stuff associated with the mission, the
right.
kind of, I don't know, PR aspects of the mission, what the mission looks like versus what the mission actually is.
Exactly.
And it seems like, you know, from someone who does not spend time in stability ops, that's where a lot of our struggles are. And you started to touch on this, that it's not so much, you know, like you're saying, the country team is successful, but when it gets bigger than that, it gets messier and there's more friction. We're less efficient, less effective. So what are some successes that kind of stick out to you in your experience in Thailand? And what do you think that tells us about country team level management and strategy?
Okay. One of the ones that quickly comes to mind is we actually spent a lot of time trying to, it's not traditional military stuff, so there was some friction over we were doing it, but we were utilizing U.S. National Guard members for mm-hmm. the state partnership program to provide disaster relief assistance for the Thai government and their mm-hmm. FEMA equivalent over there. And over time, that really started resonating within the Thai structure. It allowed us also to have a lot better interaction with them when we did have to respond to humanitarian assistance or disaster relief. But to me, one of the bigger success stories, although some were frustrated they didn't ask for our help, but that's ultimately where we want to go. And one of the recent flooding things, they said, we've got this.
That's great.
And
that's ultimately our goal,
right? Yes.
Because our goal is not to be everywhere all the time. It's to be everywhere we are needed all the time we are needed. So to not be needed is that's the outcome we're looking for, right?
Exactly.
So kind of thinking from your experience in Thailand, what do you think are some bigger lessons about stability ops, whether it's how we understand them, how we execute them? You know, does it make sense to keep disaster assistance in kind of the same umbrella as post-conflict? I don't know, what are your thoughts?
There are similarities in that, because like I said, the very nature of it is you are working what we would call joint interagency, intergovernmental, multinational, JIM is how you'll hear it described at the Pentagon. We are working in that in all those environments, but there are very different aspects to it. And like I said, the bigger problem, I think, is there's a lack of, technically, even in the post-conflict, it is State Department lead, mm-hmm. but in practice, that gets really fuzzy, mm-hmm. especially if you have a huge military footprint in that country.
Sure. And what about it is fuzzy? I mean, I think there are some kind of gut reactions as to why it's fuzzy, but I also think we spend a lot of time just saying things are fuzzy instead of kind of pulling it out and saying, okay, what is really causing this friction? So from your experience, what do you see? I mean, obviously everybody wants the same thing at the end of the day. So is it a difference in approach? Is it a difference in communication style?
It's all of the above. And that's a very good framing of it, I think, actually. And it's almost a cultural issue.
Sure.
And I can't agree more. I think our counterparts in USAID, State Department, everyone is working hard to do what they believe is the right thing and in the best interests of the nation. I really believe that.
Yeah.
Very few exceptions to that. But often what happens is we don't understand each other very well, and we create friction that doesn't need to exist because of cultural misunderstanding. And it's not just the host nation culture we got to worry about. We got to worry about each of our interagency counterparts' culture.
So I know one thing that the U.S. military does quite a bit of in building strong international ties and methods of communication between countries is mill-to-mill engagement, right? So do you think there's an opportunity for stability ops to benefit from, I don't know, I don't want to say mill-to-mill-like engagement, but almost like that, you know, some sort of exchange between DOD, state, et cetera, you know, how do we solve this problem?
I agree with you. It is a big problem, and a lot of it has to do with funding and staffing levels.
Sure.
And so, like, for some of the training exercises I support in and out of uniform now, we'll request USAID or State Department to send people to participate to get that, you know, realistic feel to it. But often the answer you'll get is we don't have the people, we don't have the time,
sure.
those types of things. Whereas I think that's the biggest thing missing is integrating those folks into training, because there is some exchange of, you know, we do have Marines in the State Department and USAID and vice versa. They do send poll ads out to the units, and USAID in particular with their DART teams is very active in training with DOD folks, but it's limited. And there are success stories within that, but it's not institutionalized, I think, is probably the bigger problem.
Yeah, and it really sounds like from what you're saying is that finding a way to not just have vertical integration but horizontal integration would make a lot of difference regardless of where you are. Because, you're right. It clearly, you know, everyone's working for the same end goal. You know, everyone wants not to be needed. But it's really hard to do that when the only time you see each other is when you, you know, are assisting in disaster relief. Because if you've had, you know, limited training together, certainly there's a significant amount of training that goes on, you know, in everyone's silos. But joint operations training is an important component of success. Because you can't just kind of think about it, right? You have to actually try it first. That's what I gather. And it's probably better, as recent history has told us, or shown us, rather, that it is better to try things in a training environment than it is with, dare I say, live ammo.
Yeah.
So how do you think things would be different now if there was stronger integration?
Now, in terms of how we...
Yeah, how we do, how quote-unquote, we do stability ops, or, you know, do you think that we would be in a different place in Iraq or Afghanistan or Burundi or Somalia or South Sudan if, and, you know, and obviously those are not all places that have equal-sized U.S. military footprints, but right. there is U.S. presence in some way in all of those places. Do you think any of these places would look different from how they look now if we had stronger communication between our own people?
Definitely. And no matter what, at least it would have been less costly and more efficient. Even if the results might not have been much different,
mm-hmm.
we would have saved a lot of resources in the process of getting to where we're at in some of those places now. But I think you would have had a much better chance at success with some better inputs early. And one of the bigger issues within the friction points is its timelines.
Absolutely.
The military, we tend to operate on a very short timeline. You know, in the Marines, you might have a 7-month deployment, depending on your unit's
right.
deployment. Army, maybe a little over a year. But at the end of the day, you're thinking 1 year, and you got to deliver something.
Right.
Whereas your USAID counterpart or Department of State counterparts thinking much more long-term traditionally
right.
than that. And that's a large part of the friction is those processes for them to get aid and development going are too slow, at least in the minds of the
military.
Guys on the ground.
Right, and it's very interesting because, of course, military strategy takes about a 20-year approach. And then it's broken down into different units of time, depending on where you are in the command structure, or what service you're in, or what your function is. And there's good and bad to that, certainly. So it's not that, of course, you know, the Marine Corps only plans for 7 months at a time, but you're responsible, you as an individual, depending on your role, perhaps for only 7 months at a time, and it is somebody else's. You know, you're a piece in a puzzle. Which is an interesting and efficient and in some ways incredibly effective way of handling things because not everybody has this burden of 20 years on their shoulders. But at the same time, your definition of long ball is different as opposed to your counterpart at state or at aid. So it's really interesting to hear you point that out because it makes a lot of sense. And I think perhaps it's just something that we don't recognize, right? Unless you've been involved in these exercises, in these deployments, you just have no idea. And you read about it on the news or you listen to it on NPR or wherever else you consume your information, and you think there's something much bigger at play here when really it just seems to be about logistics in a way.
It often is. And I think it's Comer's book, Bureaucracies Do Their Thing. And so institutionally, we do what we do. And sometimes we need somebody outside the institution to tell us this is wrong or there's a better way.
Right.
It's probably the better way to say that.
Yeah. Nothing the Marine Corps does is wrong, to be clear.
Never.
Never wrong. No, I mean, that's really interesting to think about. And I'm sure, you know, our listeners, there are some light bulbs going off right now because I'm sure everyone can hear that there's a light bulb going off for me. So we're getting towards the end of our interview, and it's a little early to ask this question of what's next. But if you're comfortable, I'd like you to go a little more in depth than we normally ask of people. And that's, okay, what do you see is next for stability ops in general? And what's the next step to make this kind of interagency integration a possibility? Is this something that needs to happen at the unit level? Is this battalion? Is this combatant command? You know, is it even a smaller region than that? Is it country level? What are your thoughts?
Wow, that's a lot.
It's a big question.
There. Yeah. The first one I'll try to address is one of my concerns outside of uniform, having left what I would argue my entire career was really about stability operations,
mm-hmm.
even if it's regional or otherwise.
Sure.
It was really about failing or failed state management.
Mm-hmm.
And all the interventions, all the things we did was related to that. But what I see now is there's a movement. I wouldn't say it's total movement within DOD itself to say, hey, this stability ops stuff is messy. It's dirty. We're not going to play.
Right.
We don't want to do this. let's get to the good old days of, you know, pure good old war fighting, major combat
when
operations.
When was that?
And that's exactly right. It never really existed.
Right.
There's always been this gray kind of area that we have to operate where you intermingle civilians and military, and inherently you need other agencies to support you on that. And that is my concern that, you know, that, you know, I think it's Trotsky once again, it, you know, we may not be interested in stability ops, but it's interested in us.
Right.
And so at some point we have to anticipate that we will still have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
My experience in Iraq when we first went in was appalling after.
Mm-hmm.
We did a very good job of knocking out Saddam Hussein and taking over the country, but we had no idea what we were doing after.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were making stuff up at the unit level and some good successes happening, but there was no interagency support, at least down at those levels, and there was a lot of unnecessary mistakes made because of a lack of thought applied to, hey, we've got to think about what comes next, or actually winning here is handing over and creating a stable government after we leave.
Sure.
And we never really got there in Iraq. And I use the firefighter analogy. We will often chase the smoke and the flame instead of, you know, what are those sources of the fire?
Right. And, you know, it sounds like the military cannot be everything to everyone all the time. And so one of the benefits of stronger interagency collaboration is that perhaps it's the military's responsibility to chase the smoke and the flame, and it's somebody else's responsibility to be in charge of the root cause, you know, of the tinder, because otherwise you just have a completely militarized society, and you get into that gray area where we started talking of the military training the police, which,
right,
you know, for the sake of efficiency, et cetera, you can sort of understand, but you also understand the concerns there.
Yes.
So the second half of this what's next question is, of course, 20 years from now, what does the world look like? Do you think stability ops will have changed, that we'll be doing a better job than we are?
I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
And I think there's room for hope.
Yeah.
There has been some of the exercises I've participated in recently. We are talking more about it. There was this, you know, I would say post, we're out of, you know, we ended combat operations in Afghanistan, desire to be done with this. But I see it coming back now, primarily because not just what's going on in the Middle East, but as well as Russia and Ukraine, we're starting,
sure,
to get into this in China as well with their little blue men versus little green men.
Yeah.
Those things short of war, putting pressure on us, that how do we handle this? Those are inherently dangerous to handle purely from a military,
absolutely,
perspective, because we're trying to avoid the bigger war or the bigger conflict.
Absolutely. And there, it's much as a lot of ASP's work kind of indicates, right, there is there's an iron fist inside a velvet glove.
Yeah.
And the role of diplomacy, the role of diplomatic efforts in whatever form they take cannot be overstated, because it's nobody's true desire to end up in a cold or hot war, right?
Yeah, no, I can't agree more. In line with what ASP does as well, I think if you look at the future with climate change and even energy security stuff, I think key areas that ASP does a lot of good work on, you are now looking at, I would argue, in 20 years, a lot more instability in a lot of these areas that are already under stress. A lot of those states that are under stress, like the Bangladeshes or some of those states that are heavily affected by climate change and,
absolutely,
will have energy security issues.
Yeah.
It will make the chances for greater stability operations and better ability to address those root causes quickly and promptly to help the U.S. stay, you know, as a guarantor of security in the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, thanks for joining us. It was wonderful to have you. It's been What's Next for American Security.